WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Hollywood hands down the Ten Commandments again. The story of Moses is retold in the new animated film, The Prince of Egypt. We'll talk with Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, who consulted on the film. His latest book interprets the biblical story of the Jews' exodus from Egypt. Then we'll hear from Charlton Heston, who played Moses in the Cecil B. DeMille epic, The Ten Commandments, and Elmer Bernstein, who composed the music. And while we're on the subject of biblical epics, Martin Scorsese will talk about shooting The Last Temptation of Christ. Also, film critic John Powers reviews You've Got Mail. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. For the second time in American history, the full House of Representatives is debating impeachment of the president. Lawmakers are expected to vote either later today or early tomorrow on four impeachment articles. NPR's Madeline Brand reports.
The debate almost mirrors the one that took place last week in the House Judiciary Committee. Republicans say the president committed perjury and obstructed justice, crimes that violate his oath of office. Democrats argue that the president's actions do not constitute high crimes and misdemeanors, and to remove him mocks the Constitution. They also repeatedly question the timing of holding today's hearings as the military campaign against Iraq continues. Michigan Democrat John Conyers.
To be spending time of this House to smear our commander-in-chief when brave men and women are risking their lives for their country shocks the conscience.
Republicans counter that weighing the president's fate at this time will not damage troop morale in the Gulf, and that the world will have the opportunity with these hearings to witness democracy in action. Madeline Brand, NPR News, Washington.
Republican lawmakers are supporting House Speaker-elect Bob Livingston despite his admission of adultery. Livingston says he was forced to admit the affairs because his personal background was being investigated. The speaker-elect revealed the news to Republicans last night during a caucus. GOP lawmakers are drawing a distinction between Livingston's case and that of President Clinton. They say Mr. Clinton's case has never been about sex, but rather lying under oath. Witnesses in Baghdad, Iraq, say air raid sirens are sounding again for a third night. There is no evidence yet that a third night of bombing is yet underway in Iraq, but there is great expectation that bombing will begin again. There is speculation that the bombing will end this weekend when the Muslim holy month of Ramadan starts. American officials haven't publicly remarked on the matter. NPR's Eric Weiner is in Amman, Jordan. He says the Arab world expects the attacks to stop when Ramadan begins.
The upcoming month of Ramadan, when Muslims fast during daylight hours for an entire month, that is on people's minds here. And the expectation among these worshipers, these protesters, is that, yes, the U.S. will stop the bombing raids before the start of Ramadan, which is really this weekend. In the past, Muslim countries have continued waging battle during Muslim months. The most prominent example is the Iran-Iraq War between 1980 and 1988. There was no timeout there for Ramadan, but of course that was two Muslim countries doing battle with each other. In this case, you have Iraq, a mostly Muslim country, and the United States. It could be a very different situation.
NPR's Eric Weiner. This is NPR. In NPR's business update on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 10 points at 8,885. The NASDAQ is up more than 21. On a day that investors have a lot of distraction, the stock market has been moving up and down. There is some end-of-the-year portfolio readjustment going on, too, as the last days of 1998 come to a close. NPR's Jack Speer reports.
Bombing raids against targets in Iraq and the kickoff of presidential impeachment proceedings here in Washington are giving the markets lots to keep an eye on today. However, at least so far, there has been little reaction from Wall Street to the latest developments. There is also what is known as triple witching taking place today. That's the simultaneous expiration of stock index futures, options on individual stocks, and stock index options, which is likely to lead to heavy trading as big investment funds realign their portfolios to prepare for the new year. Stock in shipper FedEx is higher at midday. That follows word the world's largest cargo shipping service and the union representing FedEx pilots have reached a deal on a tentative new contract. Some technology stocks are also ending the week on an up note, including Amazon.com, which is up $7 a share today. Online auctioneer eBay rose more than $16 a share. Jack Speer, NPR News, Washington.
Leading American automaker General Motors says it will increase its stake in Japan's Isuzu Motors. GM will pay nearly $500 million to increase its interest in Isuzu to 49%. GM currently controls 38%. At the same time, Isuzu will be granted full responsibility to develop commercial vehicles for GM. Mortgage rates are low. Freddie Mac says the average 30-year fixed-rate home loan was about 6.69% this week. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Beginning today, filmgoers have the chance to answer an important question. Who is the more convincing Moses, Charlton Heston, or Val Kilmer, the voice of Moses in the new animated film The Prince of Egypt? We'll hear from Heston later. Here's Val Kilmer in the scene where Moses learns he's not an Egyptian prince after all. He's a Jew. Jeff Goldblum is the voice of Moses' brother Aaron, Sandra Bullock the voice of their sister Miriam.
At last.
At last.
Didn't I tell you, Aaron? Didn't I tell you? I knew he would return to us when he was ready.
Miriam, do you want us flogged?
I knew you cared about our freedom.
Miriam. Freedom? Why would I care about that?
Because you're our brother.
What?
They never told you?
Who never told me what?
But you're here. You must know.
Be careful, slave.
Oh, my good prince. She's exhausted from the day's work. Not that it was too much. We quite enjoyed it. But she's confused and knows not to whom she speaks.
I know to whom I speak, Aaron. I know who you are. And you are not a prince of Egypt.
Miriam, what did you say?
Oh, Your Highness, pay her no heed. Come, Miriam. May I discuss something
no,
with you?
Aaron, no, please, Moses, you must believe.
That's enough.
You were born of my mother, Yocheved.
Stop it.
You are our brother.
Now you go too far. You shall be punished.
No, please. Your Highness, she's ill. She's very ill. We beg your forgiveness. Please, Miriam,
no,
let us go.
Our mother set you adrift in a basket to save your life.
Save my life? From who?
Ask the man that you call father.
Rabbi Burton Vazotsky was a consultant to the animated film. His latest book, The Road to Redemption, is an analysis of the Bible's Exodus story, the story of how Moses led the Jews out of Egypt and slavery. Rabbi Vazotsky leads the Bible interpretation seminars that inspired Bill Moyer's PBS series on the book of Genesis. Vazotsky teaches at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York. He says he thinks Exodus speaks to our late 20th century condition.
Well, I think one of the things we struggle for, which is in essence the Israelites' struggle in the book of Exodus, is a sense of community and an enduring sense of where we're headed. In America, our country seems like we're scattered, like we have no sense of purpose, like we don't exactly know where we're going. And the disparate parts of our community are often at one another's throats. You're black, you're white, you're Republican, you're Democrat, you're gay, you're straight, you're man, you're woman, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the Jews in Exodus coming out of Egypt, part of their enslavement is that they were enslaved to those kind of divisions. They were tribal rather than national. And Moses' struggle as leader is to find a common ground with all of them and to find a way to unify them, even as they maintain their individual identities and their tribal identities. They had to become one people, and they had to learn to have this covenant that bound them together and gave them a sense of purpose. Ultimately, I think they found it when they got to Mount Sinai. So we here now in the 20th century, I guess, are looking for our Mount Sinai.
I'm sure this is one of the reasons why you chose Moses as the book sequel to your Genesis book. Are there other reasons why you chose the Exodus story?
Well, I had been struggling in Genesis for a long time. You may recall when you interviewed me 2 years ago that what I wrote in Genesis of Ethics is that essentially the book of Genesis is a book about sex and violence. It was almost too easy for me to write that book about sex and violence and make it very racy. And it became very clear to me that the writers of the Bible knew very well, even as they were writing Genesis, that there was also a sequel, that there would be Exodus. And what happens, I think, is that you have to confront Exodus because it's there that you put behind some of the immaturity of the growth stages. You put behind a lot of the family dysfunction, and you move outward towards community. Once you've resolved a lot of the family issues, you grow. And as you grow, you look towards your community, towards your nation, towards what commits you and your family to greater things. And that's exactly what happens in Exodus. What in Genesis was a family story, that family in Exodus becomes a nation. So Exodus, for me, kind of was a necessary sequel, and in some very profound way, it was a necessary sequel in my personal growth. It was all too easy when I was younger to kind of wallow in the dysfunction of Genesis. And I just had my 47th birthday, and I'm now married for the second time and very happily married. I have two kids, and I just feel much more settled in my life and much more a member of the greater community. I worry about what goes on in the Jewish community. I worry about New York City, where I live, and I worry about the nation. And I think that that just comes with growing up. And the Genesis-Exodus flow seems to me in some way to mirror all of our lives.
In the Exodus story, Moses is born right after the Pharaoh has decreed that all newborn Jewish sons must be killed. So to save the baby, he is put by his mother and her daughter in, you know, like a little basket, and they float the basket in the bulrushes where it's discovered by one of the Pharaoh's daughters, who rescues Moses and brings him up as her own. This raises a lot of confusing questions, which you go into in your book. For instance, I mean, wouldn't Moses have been circumcised, and wouldn't that have been a giveaway that he's Jewish?
I think it's pretty clear that Exodus kind of revels, delights in this conspiracy of women. The mother and sister of Moses save him. They set him afloat, and they set him afloat very much in the same way that Noah is set afloat. He's going to be the survivor. He's going to be the one that's going to raise a new nation and start a new world. So the women do this, the Jewish women do this with faith in God. Because God is God of the universe, there are also complicit actors on the Egyptian side. Pharaoh's daughter, of all things, she who grows up in Pharaoh's household, she serves God's purpose by raising Moses. I think you're right. It's absolutely clear. They must know this is a Jewish baby. When Pharaoh's daughter pulls Moses out of the river and seeks a wet nurse to suckle the baby, Moses' sister Miriam steps forward at that propitious moment and says, gee, I could suggest somebody. And lo and behold, Moses goes back into, literally into the bosom of his family so that he can be suckled by his own mother. Ultimately, of course, mother and sister have to give the boy back to Pharaoh's household, where he is raised by this wonderful woman who takes a risk. She essentially defies her father, and in defying her father, brings this Jewish baby into Pharaoh's court, and now there in Pharaoh's palace, all of a sudden, Pharaoh's a grandpa, and, you know, he has this sweet little Jewish boy. It's bizarre irony, because this is the same guy who, of course, is killing Jewish babies. But it shows us, I think, a moment that the miracle maybe of what a baby can do, that someone who is as so clearly played as the heavy, as even Pharaoh, has to reckon with the fact that you have a grandchild in the house. Well, all right, that kid is going to be your boy. And so Moses is able to grow, and God takes advantage of the fact that human beings are in the end human and can't resist small children.
So you think that the Pharaoh also realizes that this baby is Jewish?
Well, a great deal has been said about the circumcised baby Moses. Some people who are Bible scholars suggest that the Egyptians also circumcised, so it may not be a giveaway. But frankly, circumcised or uncircumcised, even if you leave the baby's diaper on, you got a baby floating in the river in a little basket when all the other Jewish babies are being killed. Well, odds on are good that that's a Jewish baby who somebody's trying to save. Pharaoh has to grapple with it somehow. Maybe Pharaoh's daughter keeps it a secret. Maybe not. I wonder in The Road to Redemption about what so much that's unsaid in Exodus. When Moses grows up in Pharaoh's court, who knows that he's adopted? Who knows that he's Egyptian? Who knows the real secret that he's an Israelite? What do they do about it? How do they treat him? Is he treated differently? In any case, we learn from the Bible story that Moses is a child who grows up with some kind of a speech impediment. So something is setting him apart from beginning to end. And when that fateful day comes, and we don't know what precipitates it, Moses comes out of the closet. He joins his Israelite slave brethren and leaves behind forever his patrimony of growing up in Pharaoh's palace.
When God calls Moses to deliver the Jews from their slavery in Egypt, Moses is reluctant to follow God's will. Moses says, please send someone else. And he explains, I'm not a man of words, for I am heavy-mouthed and heavy-tongued. You've gone through a lot of the interpretations, modern and ancient interpretations of the Exodus story. What are some of the most interesting interpretations you found of Moses' reluctance to follow God's will?
Well, this is one of the places I think that Exodus departs radically from our modern culture. Exodus is very much a piece with the rest of the Bible. When God calls prophets, it's a standard motif in the Bible for them to refuse, for them to feel humble, for them to say, I can't do it. I can't speak. I don't do this well. Please send someone else. So Moses is the first in a long line of people who demur when the call comes, very, very unlike our national leaders who spend their lives from childhood aggressively pursuing what it is they want. And I think perhaps that may account for some of the differences in leadership between the biblical models we have and the very harsh reality models we sometimes face today.
Is Moses already a believer when God speaks to him in the Exodus story?
I think Moses is as much of a believer as any of us are. That is to say, it's a hard business, this believing in God. Our rational self, I think, struggles with the issue because we can't prove God's existence. And yet something deep in our soul yearns for there to be purpose in the universe and yearns for there to be a God who is fair, who is good, who will redeem us. So Moses, I think, faces all of those issues. This is a guy who, again, grew up in Pharaoh's court. He grew up in the polytheistic world of Egyptian religion. He grew up believing that Pharaoh was an incarnate God. And yet one day as a shepherd, a bush took flame. And as it took flame, he was reminded that his ancestors believed something different, that they had a very different view of the universe, that he was a creature, not a creator. So I can't imagine that from beginning to end, it wasn't always a struggle with Moses. That he, almost unique, well, unique among human beings, faced the reality of God, as the Bible says he saw God face to face and lived, I think even so, he struggled with what God is, what God demands of us, and how to confront your anger towards God, whether God is fair, whether God makes us do things we don't want to do. These are all issues, I think, that all of us confront. And Moses is, as the rabbis say, our teacher on those issues.
My guest is Rabbi Burton Vyzotsky. He was a consultant for the new film, The Prince of Egypt. His latest book interprets the Bible's Exodus story. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rabbi Burton Vyzotsky. His latest book, The Road to Redemption, interprets the Bible's Exodus story. When God calls Moses to deliver the Jews and Moses expresses his reluctance, Moses says, well, the Egyptians aren't really going to believe me when they say that you've called me, and they're going to ask me for your name. So what is your name? And God says, I will be what I will be. What are some of the interpretations of what that means?
Well, we have to revel in God's coyness. There's a wonderful rabbinic midrash from, I don't know, the 3rd, 4th century, where the rabbis point out that Moses was actually quite presumptuous at this moment. In the ancient world, knowing the name of almost anything gives you power. For instance, in the Genesis story, Adam is given the right to name all the animals, and that is the way that the Bible expresses his hegemony over the animals. He is the crown of creation, and he rules these animals because he has named them. So for Moses to ask God's name is to say, look, I need this power. I need to know that I'm really your representative because I'm nervous. But when the rabbis critique Moses, they say, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all had all these lifetime relationships with God and never asked their personal name. And you, as it were, ask on the first date. So the rabbis actually chide Moses for his presumption. And I think they kind of revel in the fact that God's answer is so ambiguous. You know, I'll be what I'll be. You can almost hear the Yiddish accent when God says that to Moses. He's really coy. God doesn't give a straight answer, even though that may, in fact, be the only answer any of us can ever have, that when we need God, God will be there. And what we need God to be, so God will be. And that's how the Exodus story turns out. So it's a descriptive phrase. And yet, at the same time, that series of verbs is a play on the four-letter Hebrew name, the tetragrammaton, that unpronounceable name of the ineffable God. So I think throughout the Torah teaches us that knowing God is an almost impossible task. I kind of, as a theologian, think of myself as holding a Groucho Marx theology. I think it was Groucho Marx who once said he didn't want to be a member of any country club that would have the likes of him as a member. And my theology is kind of something like that. I don't want to believe in a God or worship a God who I can, as a human being, so easily and readily understand. I want God to be ineffable. I want God to be, with a W, holy, other, as well as with an H, holy. So that difference, that unapproachability, is an important aspect to my concept of God. And I think that Exodus plays that out very clearly.
In Exodus, in a way, God plays a tit-for-tat game. You know, the Pharaoh had decreed that the newborn Jewish son should be executed, so God brings the plagues on the Egyptians, and one of those plagues is the death of firstborn Egyptian sons. Isn't God killing innocents here? I mean, the sons are boys. They're still innocents.
There's a great deal of difficulty with that, and it's a problem that the rabbis of old grapple with as well. They very much believe that the Bible works on a measure-for-measure principle, and so that when Pharaoh sins against God, that sin will be returned upon him. And to that extent, the rabbinic interpreters, who I guess in this instance would be apologists, want to find all kind of reasons that the Egyptians really deserved this. But in the end, I think your reading is a keen one, that Egyptian innocents do suffer God's wrath. And I think sometimes that's a real problem, how we grapple with the fairness of God, because God doesn't seem to be, at least the God of the Hebrew Bible, doesn't always seem to be fair in at least accordance with 20th century notions of what fairness is.
You know, you've said that you think Exodus has a lot of messages for us now at the late 20th century. There's a part I want to ask you what you think it says to us now. After God performs miracles, parts the Red Sea to free the Jews, and the Jews still don't get it. You know, they've kind of crossed over from Egypt. But while Moses is on Mount Sinai getting the Ten Commandments, the Jews are impatient. They start behaving badly and sinning and worshiping a golden calf. God is so angry with them, he considers destroying them. What does their behavior say to you, and what does it say to you, you know, now in the end of the 20th century?
Well, we human beings are a rough lot of people. We have our free will, and we will exercise it even at great cost to ourselves. I think our national drama these days teaches us that lesson, that however great your program may be, our personal peccadilloes can often bring us down. In Egypt, as they came out, and they were at the foot of Mount Sinai, God is saying to them, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. And they, in turn, are saying, what happened to Moses? Where is he? How come he's not here with us? Why is he on that mountain? Why hasn't he come down? God says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. And the Israelites say, this calf is our new God. At the moments that should be the most profound moments in our life, that's the moment I think that we lose faith most readily, because they're frightening moments. And that's the moment that we fail, that we back off, that we, instead of stepping forward, step backward. And that is what the Israelites do, much to God's fury.
Now, God doesn't allow Moses to enter the promised land himself. And I'm wondering what you and what scholars of the past make of that.
Well, I've actually struggled with this for a long time. And in some ways, the struggle came to me in a very profound sense, a couple of summers ago when I was in Jordan with my wife. We were on vacation, and we went to Mount Nebo, which is the mountain that Moses climbed, from which he saw the promised land, knowing that he would never enter. And according to the book of Deuteronomy, it's on that mountain that Moses died. And I stood at the top of this mountain looking, and you really can see from Mount Nebo, if you look west, you can see the promised land. You can see the Dead Sea, you can see the Jordan River, and you can see Canaan, or modern Israel, stretched out before you. And at the time, I thought, what could be a more sad place, what could be a more pathetic place in the universe than Mount Nebo, where Moses, who worked his whole life to get to the promised land, looked and realized that he would never get there. In the 2 years that have passed, I've come back to that moment again and again and again, because it so caught me up in the nostalgia of the place. And I should have been suspicious already, because I think nostalgia is a dangerous phenomenon. It is a trick of memory that allows us to remember things as we wish they were and not as they had been. And slowly I've come to realize that for Moses, standing on Nebo, seeing the promised land was the culmination of his life. He wasn't so much looking forward as looking back and realizing what he had accomplished. He was a baby boy who should have been killed and, in fact, was saved. He should have been a slave and, in fact, was raised in Pharaoh's court. He brought his people out. He was the savior of the people. He gave them law. He gave them community. And he saw God face to face. For him then, after all that, to go and conquer the land and get down to the dirty work, and it is dirty work of conquering and building and bickering, in some ways he was blessed to do without it. So he had an idealized life, and maybe at Nebo, instead of the pathos of, oh, I'm not going to get to go, Moses again taught us a lesson that sometimes you have to see where you are on the road, know that maybe you've come a long way, and that you should celebrate your accomplishment rather than regret the fact that there's one more hurdle you haven't jumped.
Rabbi Burton Vizotsky's book about Moses and the Exodus is called The Road to Redemption. He was a consultant on the new animated film, The Prince of Egypt. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear from Moses himself, Charlton Heston, and we talk with Elma Bernstein about composing the music for Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments. We're listening to music from one of three new CDs produced in conjunction with the Prince of Egypt. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Lord, I shall give these laws unto thy people. Hear me! Oh, hear me! All pay heed! The Lord Jehovah, has given unto you these 15... Ten commandments for all to obey.
That's Mel Brooks as Moses. His movie History of the World Part 1 spoofed biblical epics. My guest Charlton Heston has starred in The Real Thing.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
Charlton Heston was Moses in the Cecil B. DeMille epic The Ten Commandments, made 42 years before The Prince of Egypt. Heston's booming voice reverberated in other biblical spectacles like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. I spoke with Heston in 1990. In The Ten Commandments, you had to lead and to speak to a cast of thousands. Can you describe what went into one of those scenes, or one of the really large scenes where all the extras were?
Well, the Exodus is, I suppose, one of the largest scenes of that kind ever filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took... To get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because you... To get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur or any of those films again, because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you notice what a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But this obviously, those scenes are... In a sense, English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. You are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even
Indeed
though you know it's all stage, you've still got, what, 8,000 people following
yes,
you.
Yes, yes. It's quite an awesome experience.
Mm-hmm. Your infant son ended up playing the baby Moses in the Bulrushes.
He began playing. He ended up a writer-director. I just finished working for him.
Oh, right. Right.
So he began.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was the beginning and end of his acting career.
Right.
I think he realized the shortcomings of a career in front of the camera and quickly switched behind.
Well, how did your baby end up getting the part? I mean, the striking resemblance kind of didn't
no,
really count.
No,
you know?
I don't think a resemblance was a factor.
Yeah.
My wife, who was then an actress herself, was unable to go to Egypt on the location because she was carrying our then unborn son. And DeMille was obviously aware of this, and he said, "When is the baby due?" And she said, "In February." And he said, "That means that he will be 3 months old, if it's a boy, when we get to the shots of the infant Moses in the Bulrushes." And he said, "If it's a boy, he can play the part." And at about an hour and a half after Fraser was born, which was 3 o'clock in the morning, she got a telegram from DeMille in the hospital. It said, "Congratulations, he's got the part."
I thought you were going to say, "Congratulations, it's a Moses."
No.
You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is
telling
the Ten Commandments.
Well, which I think is perfectly logical, because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the really important action sequences.
Yeah. Category for chariot races, though.
You're right. So you had to...
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it was not... It didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture, I was a minimally competent charioteer. But as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, "You know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now. But there's just the one team out here. And when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams. And I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not." And he looked at me and he said, "Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race." As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks' work in the chariot. But he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There are all these scenes where...
action sequence,
mm-hmm.
if the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And they didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident was I drove a great deal of the sequences.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck.
Yeah.
Was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out and I didn't do that. Joe cannot, Yak's son. But Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him, because those things weighed 0.5 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, "We got to use that shot." And Jack said, "I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot?" And Willie said, "Well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in," which I did very quickly.
Charlton Heston recorded in 1990. He's now the president of the National Rifle Association.
Coming up, Elmer Bernstein on composing the music for the Ten Commandments. This is Fresh Air. In the 1956 film The Ten Commandments, the Jews marched out of bondage to a stirring score by Elmer Bernstein. Elmer Bernstein is one of the most highly regarded composers working in film. He also wrote the music for The Man with the Golden Arm, Some Came Running, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, The Magnificent Seven, Ghostbusters, Airplane, The Grifters, and The Age of Innocence. In 1991, Elmer Bernstein told me about the music that director Cecil B. DeMille asked him to write for The Ten Commandments.
The music for the film was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. Necessarily so. I mean, you know, I tell you who tried to break that, as a matter of fact, was once again Marty Scorsese in The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, sure.
In which he used Peter Gabriel doing a lot of electronic music. I think, you know, it was very interesting about that. When we finished The Ten Commandments, the music of The Ten Commandments, and I had gotten to the point at that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, Mr. DeMille, sir, and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ? He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, you know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore. In the atmosphere which exists in the world today. Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the clichés, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, like what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think, indeed, it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell, okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway, where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars? Of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday, and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There were about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it and he hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that is... accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now, but it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
Elmer Bernstein wrote the score for the 1956 epic, The Ten Commandments. The new animated film, The Prince of Egypt, cost $70 million, according to the DreamWorks studio. Martin Scorsese had a $7 million budget when he made his version of a biblical epic, The Last Temptation of Christ. Willem Dafoe played Christ, Harvey Keitel was Judas. When Scorsese spoke at New York University in 1993, he described the frustrations of filming an epic when your budget is relatively small and you're shooting on location in North Africa.
I'll never forget the surrounding of the temple. I had five guys from Rome, five stuntmen, and they had Roman costumes on, Roman soldier costumes, right? And I had to, there was a trouble in the temple, whatever, and they look up, they hear a sound, they look up and Roman soldiers come up, and then Roman soldiers come up, more Roman soldiers, and more over here. Well, I had five guys. Wow. The trick was to learn, again, go back. The whole picture was storyboarded because we had no time for anything. We had no time to breathe to get there. And by the time we got to the location, too, this was out in the desert in places, you know? And so I realized it was the old, you know, I drew the shots, and I figured, okay, I know what I have to do. But when I was doing it, I was just, oh, it was so painful. But I said, all right, this is it. Five of them come up here, flash pan, cut, same five guys. That's it. And then they had to fight the Levite guards. And they became the Levite guards on reverses. I'm not kidding. And I said, I can't believe what we're doing. I said, if I hadn't studied Roger Corman pictures, you would never be able to do this. But I mean, they were the same, the Levite guards. I couldn't believe it. I said, for the reverse, now we got, and they were all yelling in Italian It was the most despairing moment. And I had just read the reviews for Empire of the Sun and The Last Emperor from some Time magazine. I said, oh, beautiful, we're going to see the film. But look, look at all the extras he had. Oh, what have I done? I said, maybe I was just too eager to do it. Maybe I should have waited. And Michael Ball, I said, Marty, they're never going to give you that kind of extra for this picture. Let's shoot. Come on, get up. Come on, let's go. And it was hysterical. If you look at the temple scene, every shot, the same guys. Every now and then we change a helmet.
Martin Scorsese recorded in 1993 at New York University. And that ends the biblical epic portion of today's show. Coming up, our film critic John Powers reviews You've Got Mail. This is Fresh Air. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan star in the new film You've Got Mail, a cyberspace remake of The Shop Around the Corner. You've Got Mail is directed by Nora Ephron, who directed the duo in Sleepless in Seattle. John Powers has this review.
Of all Christmas movies, my favorite is Ernst Lubitsch's 1940 classic, The Shop Around the Corner, probably the most perfect romantic comedy ever made. It stars James Stewart and Margaret Sullavan as bickering salespeople in a struggling Budapest shop. Both have a secret pen pal they've never met, an idealized lover to whom they express the deep yearnings they can't express in their ordinary lives. Naturally, it turns out that Stewart and Sullavan have unwittingly been writing to one another. And what makes the story so sublime is its tender, melancholy awareness that its heroes are lonely people, caught for life in small, unglamorous jobs, who dream of finding the lover who will see them for what they really are inside. Samson Raphaelson's original script is so exquisitely crafted that it was inevitable that Hollywood would want to remake it. But for decades, that was impossible because Americans no longer wrote letters to one another. With the coming of email, however, people are again writing to one another, often anonymously. So now you've got mail. Of course, today's audiences don't want to see a film about two people in their 30s who work in a shop. That would be depressing. It would make them losers. So here, Tom Hanks plays Joe Fox, who owns and operates a chain of mega bookstores, while Meg Ryan plays Kathleen Kelly, who owns and operates an Upper West Side children's bookstore and lives in a nice sunlit condo. Similarly, the audience might think there was something wrong with Joe and Kathleen if they were unattached, so both are given strangely sexless relationships. Joe with an annoying publisher, that's Parker Posey, and Kathleen with a pretentious columnist, played by Greg Kinnear. Naturally, both Joe and Kathleen want something deeper, and secretly spend their time emailing one another, blissfully unaware that they're not only acquaintances, but they're business enemies, because Joe's new superstore threatens to drive Kathleen out of business. Since they don't know the real truth about their email partner, Joe and Kathleen's face-to-face encounters invariably lead to sniping.
You know what that hanky reminds me of?
Mm.
First day I met you.
First day you lied to me.
I didn't lie to you.
You did too.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
I did not.
You did too.
I did
you
not.
You did too.
I did you not.
Yeah, you did too. I thought all that Fox stuff was so charming. F-O-X.
Well, I didn't lie about it.
Joe. Just call me Joe.
Sure.
As if you were one of those stupid 22-year-old girls with no last name. Hi, I'm Kimberly. Hi, I'm Janice. Don't they know you're supposed to have a last name? It's like they're an entire generation of cocktail waitresses.
Look, I am not a 22-year-old cocktail waitress.
Oh, you poor, sad multimillionaire. I feel so sorry for you.
The movie was co-written and directed by Nora Ephron, who clearly has the taste for romantic comedy, but alas, not the gift. Rather than preserve the tenderness and melancholy that make The Shop Around the Corner magical, she turns everything glib and perky. Not only are Joe and Kathleen surrounded by cheaply cartoonish characters, Posey's publisher is as crass and illiterate as a Hollywood agent, but Hanks and Ryan are pushed into shtick. While he largely comes off okay, Ephron's direction is disastrous for Ryan, who's as cute as a truckload of buttons. She spends the whole movie mugging and flitting around the screen with adorably exaggerated gestures, like a mime impersonating a mime. There's so little emotion in these two, even their email is cute, that the movie is padded out with trite montages to second-rate pop songs designed to give flat material a sense of mood. We don't feel Joe or Kathleen's romantic longing, since Efren seems more interested in where they're eating on the Upper West Side than what they're actually feeling. And though Kathleen is a supposedly an independent bookseller being crushed by a chain, Ryan's so busy being cute, we never sense any passion for books. Indeed, the movie spends more time showing her hanging out at Starbucks, evidently she doesn't mind coffee chains, than it does conveying her sadness at losing her store. If Shop Around the Corner was steeped in the dreams and aspirations of the Depression era, when people sought love as consolation for material hardship, So You've Got Mail is a perfect expression of the ethos of our own time. Kathleen's small, humane bookstore may be history, but Joe Fox's book chain is shown to be a fuzzy, benevolent place. And Joe himself is the most decent mogul alive, the kind of warm, funny guy who'd never lay anyone off or pay less than a living wage. When he and Kathleen come together in their inevitable kiss, she becomes part of his world, and the movie reveals its true theme. You've Got Mail is less a story of romantic love than a cheerful myth about the heartwarming triumph of corporate culture.
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue. Randy Newman has a new 4-CD box set. One of those CDs is devoted to demos and other previously unreleased recordings. Next Tuesday, we'll talk with Newman about some of those tracks. Here's a preview. This is a demo of the song Love is Blind, which Newman wrote when he was 18 and recorded in 1968.
They say that love's a sweet thing, and for lovers the sun will always shine. But in spite of what they say, I think of love this way. Love is bitter, love is hopeless, love is blind. I learned the hard and lonely way. Love can't last through the years. I spent 1,000 empty yesterdays hiding behind a veil of tears. Now poets may write about love, and wise men may sing his praise, but I'll always remember as I go through the empty day. Love is bitter, love is hopeless, love is blind.
Randy Newman will join us to talk about his new box set Tuesday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our archive program was produced by Kathy Wolf. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.